Hello, everybody. I'm Gary Shapiro. Welcome to the podcast of From the Bookshelf.
I'm pleased to welcome Donald Spoto back to the show this week. His first book was the indispensable volume, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, which was the first book to take a look at a single film director's work and examine not only the facts of the film's productions, but also the meaning of the work and the themes and motifs that recur throughout Hitchcock's movies. Donald Spoto has written many biographies of film personalities, including Laurence Olivier and Alan Bates, Marilyn Monroe, Ingrid Bergman, and Audrey Hepburn. A theologian, Donald Spoto has also written about Joan of Arc and other theological subject matter, and his new book, High Society, The Life of Grace Kelly, is one of his most personal, combining his skills as a biographer and a cinema historian with his ability to analyze the meanings of films. Donald Spoto, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to speak with you again, Gary. Thank you.
Now, you've written biographies of both men and women, but I think your best biographies are about women, Ingrid Bergman, Audrey Hepburn, Joan of Arc. Now, Grace Kelly, talk a little bit, if you would, about writing about strong women.
Well, that's a very good question, and it hasn't been put to me before. I suppose they're more interesting, perhaps because the general readership, until fairly recently, is under the impression, as is all of society, that strong accomplishments are the purview of men. I have never had a conscious program in selecting my subjects, but now that you mention the topic, it certainly is clear that down throughout history, important advances in culture, in history, in entertainment, in politics, although that certainly is not my field, have been made by women. As we now know, and many, many women writers are turning their attention to this field, my criteria for selecting a subject, or as I prefer to say, having a subject select me, is if I'm gripped in some inner way, before I even set to the task of researching and writing the biography, am I gripped in some inner way by the life, the meaning, the art, the significance of a person? And then, frankly, gender doesn't matter to me.
Well, you know, I was referring to High Society, The Life of Grace Kelly, as your most personal book. Do you feel that way about it?
Well, I certainly feel very much that it has a special place in my heart, precisely because Grace was a very dear friend of mine, an enormously generous person to me. When I first met her, when I was researching The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, in fact, 36 years ago, and she offered to write the foreword to that book, which she did most generously and graciously, and it's still in print after 35 years, and it still bears her foreword, and that began our friendship. And the reason I praise that conduct of hers, that offering that day, was I was a beginning writer with absolutely no credits, no cachet, no nothing, even without a publisher at the time. And here was Grace, after our very first long day together, in which we spoke about Hitchcock primarily, but also others among her directors. And towards the end of the day, she said, "Well, who's going to write a foreword to your book?" And I said, "It hasn't even crossed my mind because I'm an unknown quantity." And she said, "Well, I'm always asked to endorse this product and write something on behalf of this person or that book. And for many reasons, I'm not permitted to do it." She said, "But I would make an exception in your case because I adore Hitch, and I think you're going to do a lovely book. So when you're finished, if you send me the finished manuscript or the galleys, I'd be delighted to write a foreword to the book if you would like me to, if I would like her to." And that began the friendship, and there were, you know, our subsequent visits. We just became great friends. So yes, it is a personal book.
Well, when you were visiting with her, did you have in mind that you would write a book? Did she think you would write a book, or were you just friends?
No, she was very young. She was not yet 50. I'm 12 years younger than Grace. She was born in 1929. I was born in 41. So when I met her, she was when I met her for the first time, she was 45, and I was, 33? And we chatted. I don't know, our last visit, I'm not sure if it was our last visit or our penultimate visit, but we were sitting in a lovely little room at the Palace in Monaco. It was a very hot day in August, and I remember asking her, in fact, it's all on tape, if anybody would write her biography one day, or would she write an autobiography? And she laughed, and she said, well, I'd like to think I'm too young for that right now, which she was. And she sort of winked at me and said, I don't think any biography of anybody should be done early. One needs time to think about it. Why don't you wait until 25 years after I'm gone, and then you write it and tell the whole story? And actually, we had a laugh over that, because we're the same generation. And we presumed that she would have a good long life and perhaps expire in her 80s and 90s, by which time I would be sitting in a chair with a shawl around me in retirement. But then, of course, destiny intervened, and Grace died at 52. And it was a terrible shock. I learned about it through a message on my answering machine from National Public Radio in Washington. And they wanted to bring me down to do a radio tribute for the country because my two good friends, Ingrid Bergman and Grace Kelly, died 2 weeks apart. So it was a heavy season for me. But I did honor her request. Over the years, I helped one or two other biographers because it became known, especially since the foreword to my book had been published. It was known that Grace and I were friends and that she endorsed my work. So I helped other biographers. I was not often pleased with what they wrote, but I bided my time and I waited 25 years. She died in 1982. I began work in 2007.
Well, I think it's one of your best books. It's a wonderful book. You know, Grace Kelly, she only made a few films, and you point out she made them all in a very short period of time, and she did some television, most of which is lost to us now. So why do you think there's still any interest in Grace Kelly?
Well, I think there are many reasons. One reason there's interest still in Grace is the same reason there was interest in Marilyn Monroe when I published her biography 30 years after her death. And that is, I think that in the back of our minds, we understand that we've gotten them wrong all these years. Their movies are still shown, the rumors still emerge, and yet I think people have the impression, the correct hunch, that they've underestimated them, that they've perceived them falsely. It certainly was true in the case of Marilyn Monroe, and it's true in the case of Grace. She was perceived as a Hollywood starlet who simply got her Oscar, did her work, and then married a prince and lived happily ever after. Well, this whole thing needs to be nuanced. In the case of Grace and Marilyn, both of them have been dreadfully misrepresented, I would even use the word victimized, by the most outrageous, scurrilous rumors about their sex lives that has essentially turned them into nymphomaniacs. And as a historian, that offends me because the record simply doesn't show that at all. People like to believe the worst about famous people, especially famous women, by the way. If a man is promiscuous, he's regarded as a charming roué, or he's regarded as a typical man. But if a beautiful, sexy, sensual, highly regarded star is regarded as sexy and sexually active, then she's a tramp. She's Eve the Temptress. Climbing the ladder, in order to achieve fame and fortune. This simply cannot be demonstrated by any remotely kind of elementary historical research in the case of Grace Kelly.
Of course, but even
she was a healthy, red-blooded young woman who certainly had boyfriends and was in love before she got married. As she told me, I was falling in love all the time, she said. But as you know, Gary, falling in love doesn't always mean falling in bed.
Well, I agree, but even if she had had a number of sexual liaisons, why would that matter? I mean, why should that?
Yes.
You just pointed out saying, well, it wouldn't matter if it were Clark Gable doing it, so
right.
why should it matter if it were Chris?
Well, it doesn't. As you know, I live in Europe. I'm talking to you from my home in Denmark. It doesn't matter in Europe. It seems still to matter in the United States and in Britain. It seems to matter very, very much. For example, a number of recent reviews of High Society, The Life of Grace Kelly, have scolded me for not believing that she was sexually hyperactive, which, as the reviewers continued, really put the tarnish on her reputation. You know, this is Puritan thinking. All these reviewers, I hasten to add, were men.
Naturally. Well, and you did get a very good, you inspired quite a write-up in New Yorker magazine, which must have been nice for you.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, in the reality of men in their 50s dating women in their early 20s, I think is a little weird. I mean, I think lots mm-hmm. of rich men maybe do that, but I think most people tend to date people of their own generation.
Yes, yes.
And yet in the movies, not just Grace, but also Audrey Hepburn, who we talked about a couple of years ago, they were always cast in these relationships. It's kind of hard to believe. I mean, I don't think of any Grace's movies, except maybe Bridges at Tokaree. Was she ever mated with someone her own age?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Let's talk about Audrey first. In Audrey, it's almost a kind of... It's almost distasteful. You see, Audrey Hepburn was never marketed as a sex symbol. She was never, I mean, she was a romantic figure, but she was a stained glass romantic figure. She was a model, but she was a model without a figure, in fact. So the leading men who were chosen for Audrey, starting with her first Hollywood picture, Roman Holiday, made in Europe, of course, but her leading man was Gregory Peck, who was also a stained glass figure. They were presented as lovers, but so chastely. And then, as time went on with Audrey, as you say, her leading man, are we really to believe today that in the movie Sabrina, Audrey would leave William Holden for Humphrey Bogart? This is stretching credibility, but audiences in 1954 thought it was just charming. And this went on, you know, until the apotheosis of her achievement, the greatest achievement, and the most credible, is Audrey as a nun in The Nun Story. and of course, in a number of her other pictures, Love in the Afternoon,
yes,
she's cast as the mistress of Gary Cooper, who's all practically old enough to be her grandfather. And Billy Wilder, the director, had to put, you know, gauze and Vaseline on the lens because poor Gary Cooper was not only so much older, but was also ill. He couldn't be photographed in full light. So with Audrey, it had to do with two things. It had to do with the necessity to preserve her image as this almost transcendent figure. And in addition, since she was put in Love Stories, the scenes, the love scenes, had to be made slightly off-putting. Therefore, you select older men. That's very America in the 50s. Now, in Grace's case, the only person she plays opposite who's really considerably older is in her first big picture, and that, of course, is High Noon, again with Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
But we believe it because the character Gary Cooper plays is finally getting married as he's about to retire after many years of being marshal in a dangerous town. And along comes this lovely virginal Quaker girl played by Grace. And so I think we accept that. But after that, of course, you know, she's got Clark Gable, but also in Mogambo. But vying for Clark Gable's attention is Ava Gardner, and nobody minds that. Nobody minded any girl in any movie or any woman in any movie ever vying for the attention of Clark Gable because he had a kind of ageless sexuality. Ever since Gone with the Wind, Gable stopped aging.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't, but he did. And then Ray Milland, that's not a problem.
Well, Bing Crosby.
Again, was old enough to be her, you know, old enough to be her father in Rear Window, but with Hitchcock, it never matters.
How about Bing Crosby? He was pretty old.
Bing Crosby was 25 years Grace's senior, And they did two films together, as you know. But in The Country Girl, Grace's performance is so timeless. She was 54? She was 24 when she made the movie.
And she's allegedly been married for 10 years.
She made up an act 40.
Yeah, she's supposed to have really been married for 10 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She's 40 in the movie, and she plays 40 brilliantly. Of course, the biggest difference in age with all of her characters is with Cary Grant in The Irresistible to Catch a Thief. Cary Grant was 25 years older than Grace Kelly. And when the casting was being finished, Hitchcock was, before they shot the picture, the executives at Paramount said, wait a minute. Cary Grant is 50. Grace is not yet 25. How are we going to handle this? Lots of makeup? And Hitchcock rightly said, nobody will question this. Nobody will know the difference. And to prove it, he had Cary Grant, instead of Grace, emerge like a sea god out of the water on the beach at Cannes with his perfect figure and his manly swagger, and everybody accepted that Cary Grant and Grace Kelly could be lovers. This is not a problem.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Donald Spoto, and his latest book is High Society, The Life of Grace Kelly. Now, you've written three books on Hitchcock, and Grace Kelly appeared in three Hitchcock films, was one of his most important muses. What was their relationship, their personal relationship like?
Their personal relationship was totally successful. Great fun, highly creative as well. She was one of the very few actresses that Hitch listened to and elicited her suggestions and took her advice. Usually he didn't want any of those things from actors. He didn't suffer fools or actors gladly. But Grace, having been a model, Grace knowing what the best clothes were for her and the role, simply went to Hitch and said, "What could we try this, Hitch? Would we like to try that?" And he found that her sensibilities and her contributions were enormously helpful to each of those three films, Dial M for Murder, Rear Window, and To Catch a Thief. In the case of their personal relationship, it was fun. It was friendly. It was never intimate. It was never sexual. Of course not. Hitchcock never had a sexual relationship with any of his actresses. It was look and don't touch. In the case of Grace, as with all of his actresses, he tried to catch them off guard and put them off guard by often embarrassing them with very raunchy talk. At one point, for example, early in filming their first picture, Dial M for Murder, he was telling an absolutely filthy story, filthy joke, to Ray Milland. And he did it in Grace's hearing deliberately. She told me this. And he then turned to Hitch and said, "Well, Miss Kelly, do I shock you with jokes and stories and language like this?" And she did. She looked up with a laugh. She said, "Oh, no, Mr. Hitchcock." They were still on last name terms this early. "Oh, no, Mr. Hitchcock. I went to a girls' convent school. I heard all of that when I was 12. Well, he loved that response. And, of course, that broke the ice. And Grace then said to me, "Listen, if he hasn't done it with you yet, next time you have lunch with him, I assure you he will do it to try to get your reaction. So you use my line." She said, because she knew I too had gone to a Catholic school as a teenager. I said, "You just say, 'Oh, Hitch, I went to a Catholic boys' prep school. I heard all of that when I was 13. <You know? laughs> And I did. And she was right. So there were, you know, they had a magnificent creative relationship and were friends until she died.
Now, was Hitchcock in love with her, obsessed with her, any of those things that people have said?
Well, both. I mean, and that's not surprising. First of all, as Hitch's associate producer on many of his films, Herbie Coleman, said to me, everybody was in love with Grace. You couldn't meet her and not be in love with her. I mean, you know, she was just beautiful, funny, warm, down-to-earth, generous, no attitude. Everybody fell in love with her. And she was breathtakingly beautiful. So Hitch did, too, as we see from the way he presented her. Every good director who has a leading lady of such consummate beauty has to fall in love with her in order to present her in this, you know, a fantasy romantic way on screen. Josef von Sternberg and Marlene Dietrich, even D.W. Griffith and Lillian Gish. I mean, we could go on and name, you know, sit here all the day and list the directors and the leading ladies. In the case of Hitch, obsessed only insofar as he presumed, wrongly, he presumed that Grace would give up her whole life and just make movies for him, and they would go on and do 5 and 10 and more movies together. It never entered his mind that she might like to retire from films, be a wife and mother, have a private life. That never really occurred to him with any of his stars, except the ones he didn't like that he was happy to get rid of. But, you know, that really tells the story. His obsession was never unpleasant or unfriendly for this reason. Remember, when Hitch got Grace, she already had been nominated for an Academy Award for Mogambo. She was someone to reckon with. And everything about her manner was polite and friendly and docile, but she didn't use her beauty or her talent to play little flirtatious games to try to get more close-ups or a better relationship. It wasn't in Grace's character to do that. You know, Gary, I think I've mentioned this to you when we've spoken before, but I have a motto as a biographer. A biographer is obliged to tell the truth about his subject, even if it means saying something good about them.
Well, would Hitchcock, when you say Hitchcock wanted to continue to use her, would he have put her in the shower in Psycho and so forth?
Well, it's hard to answer a subjunctive question like that because, of course, by the time Hitch came to Psycho, Grace was already married and the mother of two.
But you do mention in your book that, you know, he approached her for Marnie and she responded positively.
Oh, yes,
first.
Indeed. Indeed. Marnie was, by that point, not even a screenplay. It was a very interesting psychological novel narrated by the character Marnie, and they had no idea how they were going to turn it into a film. But all Hitch said to Grace was, listen, I'm sending you a copy of the novel. It had just been published in England. It's about a woman who's a thief and who's afraid of falling in love and has a psychological background, who's very troubled. Is this something you'd be interested in? Well, at this point in her life and career, she was certainly looking forward to resuming her career, which she never thought she'd have to give up forever. And she said yes, and Prince Rainier, her husband, said, we'll make a family holiday out of it. Hitch said, we'll do it in the summertime, bring the family to California. And that, of course, would quash rumors that there was any trouble in paradise in their marriage, as it were. But then, there have been the most awful rumors about why Grace withdrew from the project. Every writer, every journalist, every author of books has said that when the people of Monaco heard about this, they were outraged and said they would not accept their princess being in a love story and kissing Sean Connery. Well, of course, there was no Sean Connery cast in this project at the time. And nobody there had any idea of what the content would be, much less Grace and Rainier. The fact of the matter is, she had a miscarriage 2 weeks before the picture was going into pre-production, or about 6 weeks before the 19th June of 62. And not only was this, of course, a tragic event for Grace and physically very, very difficult, but she was also pitched into a terrible clinical depression afterwards. And she called Hitch and said, I just can't do the picture, and I have to withdraw. Of course, he understood. The irony, of course, is that at this very time, The Birds was running overtime in its production schedule, and they didn't really get to Marnie for a year and a half afterwards. So
it is tempting to think of her in Vertigo or The Birds or any of those
other...
Well,
Vertigo, yes. My opinion is, and I told this to Grace, and I told this to Hitchcock, and I told this to my very, very darling friend, Tippi Hedren. I'm leaving Europe tomorrow to fly to Los Angeles for Tippi Hedren's 80th birthday party. Told her, I've told Hitch, and I've told Grace, I think she would have been incredible to the public cast in Marnie, because people would have gone to see this picture. She had so much baggage. She had a backstory. She had history. It was, let's go see Grace, who hasn't been on the screen for 7 years. She's married. She's a mother of two. Could they accept her as a frigid, compulsive thief? I don't think so. Anybody who was then seeing To Catch a Thief on television, it would have been incredible. It wouldn't have been possible. Whereas Tippi Hedren had appeared only in The Birds. She had no, should I say, baggage image to bring to the picture. She not only made Marnie a far greater film than it would have been with anybody else, but people accepted that here was a woman with a troubled past. She was withdrawn, she was frigid, she had deep psychological problems, because the public had no image of her to overcome. So she created the character from whole cloth and is largely responsible for its success. I've said this on the record years before I met her.
We're talking with Donald Spoto, and his new book is called High Society, The Life of Grace Kelly. Well, how would you compare Grace Kelly's skill as an actress to, say, Audrey Hepburn or Ingrid Bergman or Marilyn Monroe, some of the other people you've written about?
Well, for one thing, Grace's career was so short. She made 11 films essentially in 4.5 years, which is a record nobody else has ever equaled. She had a year off to figure out, toward the end of her career, before she did her last two pictures, she had a year off to figure what she was going to do with her life. When she was 24 and 25, all of her friends, her sisters, everybody was married, if not also a mother at the time. Grace wanted very much to be a wife and mother. This was the really personal goal of her life. Another thing was, she loathed Hollywood. She just hated it. She never had a home there. She rented a small apartment for the time it took to make a movie, but her home was always in New York. Philadelphia girl who came to New York and went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and her heart was always in the legitimate theater. She appeared twice on Broadway, and, you know, was also a model. And then Hollywood called, for the obvious reasons. But how would I assess her acting? Far greater, on a far greater level than most people give her credit for. This is the curse of being a beautiful woman in the movies. This happened to Jean Harlow. It happened to Kay Francis. It happened to the young stars throughout the history of Hollywood. It was certainly true of Marilyn Monroe, who was never taken seriously until very late in her career with Bus Stop and The Prince and the Showgirl, and a lot of people forget about these. These are splendid performances by a deeply gifted actress. But whoever took Marilyn Monroe seriously? Beauty was a curse. In the case of Ingrid, no. From the start, Ingrid, insisting on being her natural self and winning Oscars so young, you know, 1943, Ingrid wins for Gaslight, and then wins in the 50s, 1956, for Anastasia, and then wins a Best Supporting Actress, 3 statuettes, for Murder on the Orient Express. Ingrid has a career of, you know, dozens upon dozens of movies, plus constantly working on the stage as well. In a way, it's not fair to compare them, but I would place Grace's brief career, her 11 films, I would place this on a very high level, and I personally don't want to make a choice, like an Oscar choice, which is the best.
Yeah.
Audrey gave us some absolutely magnificent performances. Roman Holiday and Sabrina, The Nun Story is simply extraordinary. She has no beauty to fall back on. She's shorn of makeup. All she has to use is her face, her expressions, and her hands. The rest is all, you know, swathed in the nun's habit. And that film, which won the British Oscar for her, is one of the great screen performances of all time. But Audrey is another case of a woman who, for whom husband and motherhood was more important. She was not going to get stuck in this, so she withdrew to have her two children, came back and did one or two more pictures, and that was that, and then gave the last 6 years of her life, as you know, to going to the most dangerous places in the world on behalf of UNICEF.
Well, do you think any of Grace Kelly's films, you would say, are one of the great screen performances of all time?
Well, I think certainly we have to take seriously her Oscar-winning performance, Best Actress of the Year for The Country Girl. Here was this glamorous, beautiful woman who made herself up into a frump, as much of a frump as Grace Kelly can ever be, even with a ratty cardigan sweater and oversized eyeglasses and no makeup. She's so beautiful, but it's a splendid performance. And I think also, if you look at her last two performances, The Swan with Alec Guinness and Louis Jourdan, and High Society, Grace Kelly in the musical High Society demonstrated once and for all that she was the great modern exponent of what we call high comedy. Sophisticated banter. If you look at the, well, any scene in High Society, but if you look at the engagement party scene where she has a mite too much champagne and dances about with everybody and she's drunk, she's hilarious. She's just hilarious. And to say nothing of the morning after, the last half hour of the picture, Grace is simply a great comedian. She showed this in To Catch a Thief also. But she was a highly sophisticated exponent of high comedy in the tradition of Katharine Hepburn, perhaps even a little more believable as time goes on. Much of Hepburn's comic work was a trifle arch. But, again, no necessity to compare. Grace was always the American girl who had a level that would surprise you. And we only have these 11 pictures. But I think that The Country Girl, Rear Window, I think certainly To Catch a Thief, The Swan, and High Society, her last picture, you know, she told me she had such fun doing it. Well, she was engaged, you know. The director let her wear her wedding ring and photographed it up close in High Society. I said her wedding ring, I meant her engagement ring.
Yeah, her engagement ring is now part of a display at the museum in San Francisco of Cartier jewels, I believe.
Oh, there's a copy of it, yes?
Yeah. Well, and I gather also from your book that you've seen a lot of what survives of her television work.
Yes, what a privilege. Grace did 36 live television shows, and wow, that was difficult work back in those days, live television, where any mistake could happen. You really had to be prepared. And in the book, as you know, she described some very funny accidents that occurred during filming of live scenes. But Grace did 36 of them, and I had the privilege of seeing over a dozen, which have been preserved, and people may see them at the William S. Paley Center, formerly called the Museum of Television and Radio, and formerly the Museum of Broadcasting, of which there are branches in New York and Los Angeles. And anyone can, and some of those are also at the UCLA Film and Theater Collection. And I spent weeks and weeks in those three places watching these magnificent performances by Grace on television. She's eye-shatteringly brilliant.
Well, choose one of those that you'd say, oh, you know, if you're going to the Museum of Radio and Television, grab this one. This is the one to see. Which one would you say is her best live television performance?
I think the Rockingham Tea Set is very good. I also think that The Killing is excellent. There's a whole number of people can take their pick. I mean, she did a Berkeley Square. She did a version of Berkeley Square that is so moving. A Kiss for Mr. Lincoln is not only funny, but very daring for the time. She did period pieces, and she did modern pieces, and she did comedies, and she did historical melodramas. And in each of them, she's eminently credible. You know, it's really quite extraordinary. She was a very busy little bee during those years. And I must say also, remembering that she came from a very wealthy Philadelphia family, when she went to New York at the age of 18 and enrolled at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, intending to be a serious theater actress, she did this on her own without any financial support from her parents, and she got work as a model. And in a very short time, she was one of the highest paid models in New York. paid $4,000 a week, which is something like $50,000 in today's valuation. So, you know, this needs to be said. I think she was an independent lady.
And the fact that she had some personal wealth as a result of her family and her modeling, she was able to really buck the studio system. She's really one of the first to really successfully do that, I gather.
Oh, yes. In fact, one of the major points in the book, as you know, that I make is Grace Kelly essentially helped to put the final nails in the coffin of an exploitive Hollywood studio system. She was under contract to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Legally, she was obliged to do whatever film they gave her. The system operated this way. If actors refused the assignments they were given, no matter how inappropriate, no matter how much it might harm their career, no matter how much they hated it and felt they wouldn't give a good performance, if they refused, they were put on suspension, not paid, and effectively, that's how Hollywood careers got ruined. That is, by thinking actors and actresses. Poor Betty Davis went through hell with Jack Warner, as we know. That's a matter of history. So the point is, Grace, who preferred to do stage work in New York anyway, was given these wretched scripts and kept saying no, no, no. And finally, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer said, well, we can't put up with this anymore. They put her on suspension, but their timing wasn't very good. It was the very week she was nominated for the Academy Award for The Country Girl. So here's her home studio, for which she had been loaned out to Paramount Pictures. Mostly in her career, Grace was loaned out by Metro to Paramount Pictures. Most of her pictures were for Paramount. And so what happened was they found themselves in the embarrassing position of putting on suspension and punishing one of the most beloved and honored actresses in Hollywood. And it's also important to mention that Grace came by her theatrical genius, if you want to use that word, honestly, because her uncle was the great American playwright George Kelly, who wrote The Torchbearers, The Flattering Word, you know, a number of huge Broadway successes, most of which were turned into movies. And he was Grace's big champion and her advisor during, it was he who advised her to do The Swan as a feature, because he knew she enjoyed doing a brief version of it, an abbreviated version of it, for television back in 1950. So Grace's love for New York, her love for the theater, and her financial independence because of her earnings as a model, and because she never wanted to live in a, you know, 45-bedroom mansion in Los Angeles, gave her the freedom and the independence to say, no, I won't do it. I just won't do it. You can't treat us this way. And it was really one of the nails in the 7-year studio system. She and, of course, the great Olivia de Havilland also made that achievement.
I want to ask you about Donald Spoto for a minute. It seems that there are certain passions of yours that surface in your books. That is, you're interested in writing about tolerance or intolerance. You're interested in writing about religion and the way religion factors into the work of artists and people. And you're interested in people's mistreatment of others or disrespect of others. Or, on the other hand, their humanitarian efforts. Are those the things that you look for when you're writing a book?
I don't think, Gary, that I consciously look for them, but I suppose I'm attracted to people whose lives, as well as their works, demonstrate some shining aspect of human capability, their art or their life. Certainly I've written about people who are psychologically troubled and disturbed and unhappy, Alfred Hitchcock perhaps primary among them. But the body of his work is so illuminating of the human condition. To put it this way, the body of his work is good for us. It's good for us. Hitchcock knew the difference when telling stories between good and evil. And you don't walk out of a Hitchcock film feeling, gee, evil's pretty good, let's try some. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work. These are not moral tracts. These are not sermons. They're human documents. When it comes to the subject, I like to say the subject chooses me. I knew Ingrid Bergman. I admired her work hugely. I admired the enormous courage with which she faced the last 8 years of her life in dreadful suffering with cancer. I admired her, like Grace, I admired her independence, her refusal to kowtow to the Hollywood system, and I hated the way she was treated by the American people, indeed by the American government, when she had the nerve to conceive a child out of wedlock and then dare the child out of wedlock and was not allowed to come back to the United States because she was called a force for moral evil against our young people. I mean, that story deserved to be told. That's a dark moment in American history where a good woman, and by the way, you know, today she would have been on the cover of Time magazine.
That's right.
And would be given more offers than she could possibly accept for being an unwed mother and having the child.
Right.
But the kinds of people who interest me are people who, I guess to put it briefly, did good work and also had a frame of reference outside themselves. Ingrid cared about other people. Audrey cared about suffering children of the world in places torn by starvation. If Audrey were alive today, she'd be on the first jaunt by boat or by plane to Haiti to help, because that's what she did for UNICEF. Grace was an enormous force for good in Europe and in her tiny little town, the Principality of Monaco. What she did was fantastic with the Red Cross and for culture. She turned a place, as the great writer Somerset Maugham called it, Monaco is a sunny place for shady people. She and her husband turned that around and made it a cultivated place where everybody was welcome and where the arts flourished as they had not for many, many, many decades. So, you know, I don't want to write about, I can't write about sports figures and scientists and politicians. It's not my gift. That's not where my gifts are, whatever those gifts are. But in the arts, what interests me is how people have a frame of reference outside themselves, how they cope with fame. Does it destroy them, or does it, in fact, winnow them and humanize them? And many of the people I've written about preserved their humanity and polished it and, you know, they left the world a better place. What can I say?
You know, not many people have done what Grace Kelly did. I think Garbo, Louise Rainer, who just turned 100 the other day, and Deanna Durbin. Those are the three people I can think of who walked away from a successful career, never to return. And now in your book, there's this moment, and it kind of almost slips by, in which Renier and Grace are having a little sort of a press conference with her family, and he just kind of mentions that she's not going to be making movies anymore. Is that kind of how it was broke, the news was broken to Grace that she would be making no more
movies? Well, it was, as you rightly said, it was said during a press conference, and I think his exact words were something like, well, she won't have time to make movies anymore. I think that this was interpreted to mean, and certainly interpreted by Grace to mean, look, she's got an enormous alteration of life and lifestyle. She's going to be a mother. She's going to be my helper as Princess of Monaco. Let's not talk about making movies. One can only do certain things at a time. I think she certainly presumed that for, you know, at least 5, 6, 7, 8 years, she would be deeply involved in doing good work in Monaco and being a mother, and she was always a hands-on mother. After several miscarriages, she had her third child, as you know, Stephanie, in 1965. Grace was 35 at the time. And she wanted to have more children. But as the final years of her life demonstrate, she was making a comeback. She first of all did poetry readings on stages all over the world. She did dramatic readings. She narrated several documentary films. And then, of course, not long before she died, she appeared as herself in a riotously funny comedy called Rearranged, which I have had the privilege of seeing a number of times, thanks to the courtesy of the writer, and her co-star, her husband, Jacqueline Monsigny and Edward Meeks, I don't think that film will ever be released, because when it was being finished, Grace died, and the master print is in the archives of the Palace of Monaco, and I think there it will remain forever, sadly. But I hope I don't go too far from your question. She didn't. She knew that there would be a period of time, and she wanted a period of time. She was sick and tired of the movies and Hollywood with all its neuroses, and spoke quite frankly about that. But I think she felt she would at some point go back to work. Not necessarily in the movies, maybe she could do a play.
And you think if she had lived, then you have no doubt that she would have.
Oh, I do. Oh, absolutely. Rearranged would have been, would have had its final editing and would have been screened, and they would be, she would be besieged, because it's such a hilarious performance of typical French farce comedy of mistaken identity in which she plays herself. And it's just, she's more beautiful, more funny, her timing is good. I mean, it's just a glorious piece of work.
No, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, once that would have been screened and it was to be premiered on American Television Network, Grace would have been besieged with offers. I don't think there's any question that she would have gone back to work on her own terms, however.
Well, Donald Spoto, you knew Grace Kelly fairly well, and you've been talking about her, how funny she is in the movies. Was she funny? Was she a funny person?
Yes, she was. More than anything else, Grace loved, as people said, to have a giggle. She really did. She had a highly sophisticated sense of humor, and as she said to me, you know, Cary Grant and I had so much fun doing To Catch a Thief because we both have, her word, a weird sense of humor. And, you know, they saw the ironies in life. They saw the inappropriateness of things. And she had a slightly risque sense of humor, which was charming. It wasn't gutter humor. But, you see, people think of her as this aloof, cool, ice goddess princess. Nothing could have been further from the truth. You know, I have kept the tapes of my conversations with her after all these years and preserved them on CDs now. And you hear Grace giggling and laughing, and you hear me saying, what's funny? I didn't get it. And she tells this little anecdote or this little story, whatever it is. And she's just great. You know, she was just a glorious person to know, and a generous, warm-hearted lady.
Well, I have a question, Dr. Spoto, about high society, the life of Grace Kelly. It's you don't get to the point where she marries and leaves Hollywood until about, I don't know, 40 pages before the end of the book. Why did you not spend more time with her private years in your story?
For a very good reason, Gary, and I'm glad you ask it. Some of the critics have taken me to task for devoting only, I don't know, 40 pages or something to the second half of her life. Because, quite frankly, as she knew, it turned out to be rather dull. She was a princess, the mayor's wife. She did enormous amounts of good work, not only in Monaco, but in all of Europe, and became a mother, concerned for what were the right schools for her children, taking them to the schools, being a hands-on mother. How much time can you devote in a book to taking the children to school, having Red Cross meetings, preparing for the annual Monaco flower show? How much time can you devote to this in print before the reader takes the book and throws it against the opposite wall?
There's
a certain amount of economy. As Chekhov used to say, the writer has to know more than he tells. What I did was to try to make a very judicious extract of, A, this is the kind of work Grace did in Monaco. B, this is the kind of trials they had with raising children in a modern world who were titled royalty. This is the kind of involvement she did in the arts. This is how much she always loved ballet and narrated this film about the children of Theater Street, about the Russian, the Vaganova school. But if you go on and on for 100 pages or more detailing this, you're going to bore the reader to death. So the fact of the matter is, I tried to make a judicious extract indicating the major themes of her married life as a princess. And then when it comes to the last 2 years, then of course the interest level peaks when she gets back to making this movie, and then alas when she has a final illness that was not well treated, that led to her massive stroke at the wheel and that killed her. So,
but you do sort of drop a little, you know, a hint that maybe their fairy tale marriage was not exactly the fairy tale marriage that it was, and so forth. But we don't get a whole lot of details there.
Well, I did talk about how the period in the late 70s, where the marriage was estranged, where they this is not uncommon, is it, among people who are married for more than 20 years, where she and Renier were, if not formally, they never lived apart, but there was a separation for a while, not legal, but he had enormous responsibilities, and she had friends who were in the arts, and the children are in school in Paris, so Grace spent most of her time in Paris. That's where she and I first had our first meetings. And they got through that difficult time as the children got older. Renier and Grace got through that time, and certainly within the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years of her life, this was a successful marriage in which whatever difficulties they had were overcome. Frankly, I don't think it's necessary to try for any more than that. You know, I've never taken my readers into the bedrooms of couples, and even if material like that were known incontrovertibly, I write for adults and with respect for adults. But maybe people are disappointed that Grace didn't get divorced, that Grace didn't have an affair with a famous politician and have to shield herself from the prying eyes of the paparazzi. Sorry, folks, it didn't happen.
Well, I want to ask you, in your book, you talk about Hitchcock discussing in Dial M for Murder, that he was sort of forced to make the film in 3D, and I can't remember the exact quote, but something about how 3D doesn't bring the viewer in, but rather, you know, pushes them out and makes them aware of them. But of course now in 2010, 3D is back in a big way with Avatar and a bunch of other films. I wonder if you've seen any of these films and what your opinion of the new 3D thing is all about.
Well, I haven't. The film you mentioned has not hit where I live in Europe yet. I hope to be unprejudiced if I ever get to see it, but I tend to be suspicious of movies that have to succeed by technology, computers, high tech. I'm looking for, maybe, you know, I'm 68 years old. I give away that I'm an old-fashioned guy. But I want a human story about human conflict and recognizable human characters in recognizably human dimensions, which is why movies about dinosaurs turn me off. if you look on my DVD shelf, our shelves here at home have about 600 or 700 or 800 DVDs we haven't counted recently. But they're all stories about people that you could watch more than once. There are also the great Disney features, of course, from the 40s and 50s. But I don't know. I just feel that I'm suspicious of technology and technocracy. I'd much rather watch Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant and Hitchcock's Notorious, which you can do 500, 600, 700 times, and still it reveals new richness and depth every time you see it. It's a film made by adults, with adults, for adults.
With beautiful black and white cinematography.
With this gorgeous, rhapsodic black and white cinematography by Ted Tetzlaff. I mean, has ever an actress been so rapturously photographed as Ingrid in the final bedroom scene with a one key light when she's being poisoned at the end of Notorious? I mean, you want to just stop it and say, oh, I can't bear this anymore. It's beauty of a transcendent quality. It really and truly is.
Well, as always, you've been so generous with your time, and let me tell our listeners that the book, and they should go out and purchase it immediately, is called High Society, the life of Grace Kelly, if only so that they can take this dust cover and put it up on their wall and stare at these blue eyes of Grace Kelly. Donald Spoto, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It is always a very great pleasure for me, Gary, and I thank you for your invitation today.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf podcast. I want to thank our guest, Donald Spoto, for being here, and I urge you all to get his new book. It's called High Society, The Life of Grace Kelly. And for that matter, you should pick up his great works on Alfred Hitchcock, particularly The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, which has been on my bookshelf since 1976. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I hope you will turn your browser back this way again next week for another fun From the Bookshelf interview. Until then, I'm Gary Shapiro for From the Bookshelf. Goodbye.